Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Homelessness is rising in the Twin Ports.
It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep.
What are the reasons, and are practical solutions possible?
What we're seeing now is increased numbers of persons living in places that are unfit for human habitation.
We'll hear from those who know it best. Plus, he's known worldwide, but for January, he's playing close to home. We'll hear the music of Charlie Parr.
When I go down that funeral road, Lord, I'm gonna be dressed up fine.
All that and regional news and review after this.
I'm gonna have me a nice new suit and tie like I never could have afforded when I was alive. Well, I ain't dead yet.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Homelessness is rising in the Twin Ports.
It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep.
What are the reasons, and are practical solutions possible?
What we're seeing now is increased numbers of persons living in places that are unfit for human habitation.
We'll hear from those who know it best. Plus, he's known worldwide, but for January, he's playing close to home. We'll hear the music of Charlie Parr.
When I go down that funeral road, Lord, I'm gonna be dressed up fine. I'm gonna have me a nice new suit and tie like I never could have afforded when I was alive.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We'll hear more from Charlie Parr later in the show. But first, homelessness is one of the most persistent problems in our society, and after a significant decline 10 years ago, it's on the rise again. The website homelessness.org counts 580,000 people nationwide experiencing homelessness, considerably less than over 600,000 a decade ago, but up by more than 30,000 individuals in the last 2 years. And if you think it's just a problem affecting urban areas, it isn't. There's rural homelessness, and even a small city like Superior has an encampment under a bridge on Belknap Avenue. All of this may be becoming more visible because those encampments are increasingly colorful, thanks to tents from manufacturers like the North Face and REI. I've noticed exactly that, and our guests will tell us if it's just because I've been paying more attention or that the nature of homelessness has changed, specifically the reasons why people may live in an encampment instead of seeking other means of shelter and survival. Joining us are two experts very familiar with those issues, Chris Herring, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California at Los Angeles and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. Welcome to Simply Superior, Professor Herring.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And John Cole, the executive director of CHUM, operators of the Twin Ports' largest food shelf and emergency shelter, and more broadly, the area's primary safety net organization for people who are experiencing homelessness. Welcome, John Cole.
Thank you, Robin. It's good to be here and be part of this conversation.
So first, John, can you give us a lay of the land locally and tell us exactly who are the people experiencing homelessness in our area?
Well, when we focus here in Duluth and Superior, in the Twin Ports, we see that we have an increasing problem. Within St. Louis County, homelessness has increased over the last 13 years by 22%. And what we're seeing now is increased numbers of persons who are turning to our shelters, and also increased numbers of persons who are living in places that are unfit for human habitation. They're in encampments, in the woods, they're on the highways, and in any place that provides some sort of shelter for them. This has been driven, of course, by economic situations, the fact that we are experiencing a housing crisis here in our area, that's making affordable housing being very scarce, and also priced beyond the means of regular low-income workers. And the problem is even more exacerbated by the prevalence of mental health concerns as well as chemical substance use.
Chris Herring, how does what John described reflect national trends? And I know you've done particular work on the West Coast.
Yes, the description fits broadly. I would just say that this growth over a decade that John mentions, is very different in different parts of the country. And so, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that there was a recent increase in the last 2 years, this is almost completely, when you look at the national picture, driven by growth of homelessness in the West Coast, in places like California and often very big cities. And we continue to see actually a reduction of homelessness over the last decade in many other areas. For instance, over the past decade, there's been major reductions in what the federal government terms chronic homelessness, or people who are experiencing homelessness for more than a year or multiple times with various disabilities. Because the federal government has targeted this specific group of people experiencing homelessness, they've seen large reductions. Similarly with veterans, which was a major effort under the Obama administration and continued under the Trump administration. However, in the West Coast, and it sounds like in your community, there are still growth. It's driven increasingly by housing unaffordability. We see that in areas where housing becomes less affordable, we see the greatest growth in homelessness. And areas here out west, as well as where John mentioned, we're still experiencing cuts to mental health care and challenges such as the overdose crisis, which we hear affecting lots of communities beyond those who are just experiencing housing precarity on the rise, especially during this pandemic, which exacerbates these issues. So definitely not unique to these large cities, but also smaller cities as well, and affecting a variety of people. I guess the last thing I would mention is that family homelessness and families facing evictions has been growing, especially over the last decade. And this is also a very form of hidden homelessness, where you have families, you know, doubling up in different areas, which we don't count in the numbers you mentioned, or sleeping in their vehicles and trying to stay out of sight.
You know, piggybacking off of that, actually, you mentioned housing prices. We've had a huge increase in housing prices in both Duluth and Superior, thanks to the pandemic, because people now can work remotely. We have a beautiful area, Chris. When you come visit us, you'll agree. And unfortunately, people from larger areas, fortunately and unfortunately, have found that now that they can do their work remotely, they can do it in Duluth and Superior and pay less than they would for a house in the Twin Cities, but a lot more than our people have been paying for houses. Hence, our prices have gone up. And even if the numbers aren't in yet of the rise of homelessness during the pandemic, I would suspect we're going to see that rise. John, more than a decade ago, I spoke to your predecessors about what were then viewed as intractable reasons for homelessness. One mantra that was often repeated was that nobody wants to live outside, or particularly in our area, or be without a home. And I challenged that because there was at least one person in the area who lived in what could best be described as an igloo that was actually quite cozy and protected from the elements, because she in no way wanted to be subject to what she viewed as real, and I think she experienced as real, dangers at shelters. Has that thinking changed today about whether anybody would choose to, you know, not be in a traditional home?
That has not changed in the way that you think. And I think everyone wants a home, but there are reasons why persons would find themselves out in the street or in an encampment away from a home. You would find that with the chemical addiction and the mental health issues, that you have persons who, because of the paranoia, would not feel comfortable around other persons, so would be avoiding congregate shelter settings, I would rather stay outdoors, and we'll do so as long as it's possible. When winter comes around, then they'll take refuge in our warming shelters. There are folks, though, because of their mental impairment, have these barriers that prevent them from engaging with the services that are there to help them, and need considerable outreach to bridge that, and to be able to connect them so that they can begin to access the available services and begin perhaps that transition from being in encampments or living outdoors in unsafe situations to congregate settings or even to being housed. But it is a considerable process for folks to be able to make that sort of move. So yeah, it's a mixed bag of folks who do not want to live indoors, and those who cannot because of the impairment and would need considerable help in helping them to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with John Cole, the executive director of CHUM, operators of the Twin Ports' largest food shelf and emergency shelter, and Chris Herring, assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. Chris Herring, you've done extensive studies of tent encampments, and I have a theory that I want you to either stand up or knock down. I used to visit San Francisco yearly, and I certainly noticed homelessness out there, but I noticed it far more pronounced after not having visited for about 5 years. And what I saw that I hadn't seen before was people living in camping tents, such as from REI or the North Face. And these have popped up around the country. Minneapolis, Madison have at least a couple. There's a study of yours, by the way, in which you quote a person experiencing homelessness saying, "When I first became homeless, it drove me crazy, being out in public in parks or cafes all day, and then coming back to the shelter to sleep in public with no privacy. When I zip up my tent, I can read, watch a movie, do whatever. I can store my things here so I don't have to lug around a cart of stuff all day, and I know it's safe. It's my last piece of space, and the shelter doesn't give you that," close quote. So my theory is that these tents are now far better at protecting you from the elements than before. The rating of, 20 below or whatever is increased, and actually offer amenities, if you will, that shelters such as CHUM can't. So am I right in that observation or totally wrong?
Yeah, I think there's two parts of this issue. One is, has there been an increase or a growth of the use of tents? And then there are the reasons of why people might prefer that to other alternatives. So on the first issue, you can look at photos back in the 1930s where people are constructing tents. And, even in the early 2000s and late 90s, which I imagine is before you were speaking, unhoused folks were using tents for shelter then. And in fact, depending on when you visited for this conference, San Francisco had a boost in 2019, but it didn't experience these large growth in the raw numbers. But there was a visual change in the homelessness we were seeing in that city. And people who were more hidden in the city and could camp out in less visible areas, industrialized areas, away from residences or workplaces, just weren't seen. And so folks who used to be hidden, people will call the cops on them and they will move in and they're filling up this part of the city where when you go and visit as a tourist or at your conference, is much more visible on the sidewalks rather than on the margins. So I think it's important to, think about how, in this case, the enforcement of where you can and cannot be is really driving what we're seeing rather than necessarily, although in many places it is true, an absolute growth in homelessness. The second piece is, why would someone prefer to be be outside rather than in a shelter? On the West Coast and in some cities, it's very different than others. So, in San Francisco, where we in our last count, we had about 9,000 unhoused folks, only 38% of those were sheltered in some sort of temporary shelter. And before the pandemic, There was actually a wait list for that. So there were over 1,000 people waiting to get shelter, which would typically take 5 weeks. Or you could wait in line for a single night bed, which would often be hours waiting outside just to get a bed in one of these congregate shelters. And even if you got one of these reserve beds, after 90 days, you would have to leave and then get back on the list or do the one night bed. And this is how it is in many large West Coast cities and other cities where there's not, as in, say, New York City, a right to shelter, or in very cold places where it's very clearly a humanitarian issue of getting people out of the cold and into shelter. And so there's actually far greater demand for people to get into shelter who can't. And so it's not even a choice or a preference for some folks. Now, that being said, there are plenty of folks. I spent 57 nights out on the street with folks camping out in San Francisco, and hundreds of days. And this is where one of these quotes come from. And during that time, there are many things I preferred of being outside, considering the situation of most of the shelters, which was, you know, definitely the lack of privacy. But, you know, some people who want the safety and shelter will obviously prefer shelter to being outside. There are different dangers. Some people who were more fit and stronger, and this also plays into gender dynamics, felt safer outside with a group of people where they could protect their belongings versus inside, where things would often get stolen. And there were violence in both spaces. There were health risks of both places. You were definitely more likely to catch a cold or a sickness when I was staying in shelter, not to mention now with the situation of COVID, which have really had huge outbreaks. We just had yesterday a shelter with the Omicron going through San Francisco, where more than half of the shelter residents tested positive. Very difficult. But even before that, I'd often catch things in a shelter more often than outside. Of course, outside, you have the elements, which you're trying to protect yourself from, which, of course, is the use of the tent. Shelters, many cities have curfews where you have to be inside. For some people who are recycling or working night shifts, it doesn't work with their job. Most shelters close down during the day. So even if you have a place to sleep at night, you have no place to be during the day. Whereas if you have a camp in a community, you have that space. I think it's important. I don't know that we can hear more from John of the situation of the shelter there. But as we hear about this in different countries, it's really important to recognize what shelters do and do not offer. And also that it's often the case that shelter is simply not available or accessible to people.
I could follow up on that in terms of the unavailability. You know, homelessness is one of the things is a failure of public and private support systems. And so what we have, unsheltered homelessness has increased by 37% in our county. And that means that our shelter capacity is inadequate, woefully inadequate. We probably have 255 beds, whereas the unsheltered population is over 600. So right away, we have an excess of demand for shelter units. And so folks are forced to be outside or to sleep in the vehicles or to use tents to survive, whereas they would have rather been in shelter. Though my shelter is open 24/7, and folks are welcome to spend time there. There's still a lot of issues of privacy. For folks who have agoraphobia and cannot be around folks, it becomes an issue. For folks who have paranoia and a fear of the system, it becomes an issue. And so they would rather stay outside than being in. But when you think of the fact that 47% of the year, our temperatures is under freezing.
Well, freezing is considered warm for us. Freezing.
I
is
know.
32.
Yes.
32
I know.
Above.
Yes. 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 Remember, I'm still new to the area, so I'm getting acclimated. But you know, it becomes a natural incentive for folks to come in, and that's why we operate the warming shelters as well between November and April, and there we'll see a large influx of persons coming in who would have otherwise, for the rest of the year, will be outside. And it is a quite incredible mix of behavioral issues and mental health and chemical addiction issues and challenges that are presented as we try to save persons from the elements.
We're speaking with John Cole, the executive director of CHUM in Duluth, and Chris Herring of the University of California at Los Angeles and a Harvard University postdoctoral fellow. We're talking about homelessness and the increase we've seen locally and national trends as well. I'm Robin Washington. We'll continue our discussion and check in with the music of Charlie Parr after this.
You got a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living. See, my old man's got a problem. Yeah, but the bottle, that's the way it is. I had a feeling that I belong. Someone.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We continue with our discussion of homelessness in the Twin Ports and beyond, and in particular, its rise in recent years. That includes the proliferation of tent encampments in cities around the country, including right here in Superior. We'll rejoin our guests in a moment, but first, Wisconsin Public Radio News Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading is here to tell us about the problem locally and resources that might help in northwestern Wisconsin. Danny?
Yeah, in northwestern Wisconsin, you know, for example, we have a homeless encampment in Superior underneath the viaduct that connects the city to the Bong Bridge. And this year, the Superior Telegram has been reporting on some of the issues that they've seen with that. And Mayor Jim Payne said that the encampment grew this year for a number of reasons. You know, he cited some people who have either lost work due to shutdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic or other camping sites in Duluth that are no longer available that are drawing people to this one. And Mayor Payne also cited, you know, the number of construction workers that we've seen, you know, has increased demand for hotel rooms across the city, and some of which have been used in the past to house homeless residents. And Millie Roundsville with the Northwest Wisconsin Community Services Agency told the Superior City Council this week about some of the programs they have available to help people who are facing homelessness. And she said that right now they have almost 140 people on a list across their 5-county service area who are homeless and are prioritized for housing right now. And during the pandemic, the agency has awarded $750,000 in payments to landlords to help keep people in their homes through the Wisconsin Emergency Rental Assistance Program because of the challenges that we've seen during the pandemic. And it's an issue that's likely been on people's minds right now this week, you know, as we've seen all of the snow and extreme cold hitting the area. And in Ashland, Roundsville said there are plans underway to open the city's first homeless shelter in the former Ashland Motel along Highway 2 sometime early this year. And the Red Cliff Reservation began offering a warming shelter in the last month or so for their residents who are homeless. So it's an issue that's getting a lot more attention, especially during these colder months right now during the winter.
All right. And you'll be back with us later in the show for the news roundup?
Wouldn't miss it, Robin.
All right. That was Wisconsin Public Radio News Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading. Let's go back now to our guests, John Cole, the executive director of CHUM, the area's largest food shelf, emergency shelter, and warming shelter, as he told us just before the break, and Professor Chris Herring of the University of California, Los Angeles, and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. Danny just mentioned the Northwest Wisconsin Community Service Agency, and I should point out you can reach them at 715-392-5127. Once again, that's 715-392-5127. John, how can people get help from CHUM? Let's start with the address.
102 West 2nd Street, in Duluth. That is where persons can access the emergency shelter, emergency family shelter, and the drop-in shelter. And also, when it comes to the warming center, currently we are operating from the Rainbow Center in Duluth. That's 211 North 3rd Avenue East. Folks are able to go there and be warm and have shelter between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. in the morning.
Great. So Superior may be an exception, as Danny mentioned briefly, but as a rule, municipalities are not big fans of the encampments we've been speaking of. Chris, have you seen any municipality maybe find a better approach instead of, I know some are very draconian and they simply send in the cops and, okay, all the tents go away. But are there any more positive solutions that cities have undertaken?
There are some new experiments in responding to homelessness, diverting calls from 911, particularly since the murder of George Floyd, which raised the question of how we might respond to some things such as mental health or homelessness without a police response. One model that is often being looked at and used now in other cities is called CAHOOTS in Eugene, Oregon, where it first began and is now having trials with folks dealing specifically with mental health. The idea there is that when someone calls about a homeless issue because someone's camping or sitting on a sidewalk, which have local ordinances banning, rather than the dispatcher sending that to a police officer who will in most cases just move a person along, so they'll end up being in another area in public space, to send out a social worker either with the police officer or sometimes the social worker will go out first, and if there's some danger, they'll call on a police officer, and then work with the individual in a way that won't involve the criminal justice system. The limits to that, again, is, as we've already spoken of, what resources are available. And in cities where there aren't adequate shelter and safe places, there have been efforts to link having spaces open when they're going to go in and clear an encampment. But as I mentioned, in these places where there's already a wait list, you're basically pushing someone back who's voluntarily seeking these places in order to offer them something through what is often a complaint-driven system where you have an encampment that a business improvement district doesn't like, or, you know, wealthier residents who are organizing and calling. And so if we're not creating more resources and widening the pie, you're essentially just, you know, reshuffling the deck chairs.
Mm-hmm. Does that imply that the encampments might be permanent? I'm thinking of what I guess we used to call the third world or developing world, and places like suburban Mexico City aren't all suburbs. They were more like shanty towns that were built around very large cities, and they grow and grow. And frankly, the encampments might be mirroring that, except, again, we've got the REI and North Face tents that are quite colorful. Might they be permanent?
I think it's entirely a political decision. And I'll let John speak to the local issue there of what he thinks might improve the situation. But, you know, take at the beginning of COVID in San Francisco, we opened up a number of hotels which weren't being used to bring people inside, unhouse folks. And actually, we ended up bringing in nearly 4,000 people who were out on the streets or in some of these congregate shelters by decongregating them so they weren't as packed, opened that up in a matter of 2 months. The longer term issue of housing is going to be harder, but, you know, there are political movements and plans now. The Build Back Better plan was going to be a historic increase in funding for vouchers and the child tax credit, which would definitely reduce family homelessness and provide localities with, you know, the infrastructure necessarily to bring people inside. So I always point to other countries and Europe and other developed, you know, areas. I mean, you were comparing to the third world. Well, most other countries, including even very capitalist ones, even the UK, it does a much better job at this. We are really unique. And if the resources were put in place and the political will was there, this is certainly an issue that can be solved.
I like the way you turn what I thought was a terribly negative and dire prediction into something more positive. John, maybe you could bring us back to the reality. Locally, what are the best case and worst case scenarios? Why don't you do worst first so we can end on a positive note?
I think on the housing crisis is the largest challenge. To be able to create affordable housing units in this market, it's incredibly challenging. And I think that's a ways out. And in the meantime, what we have is over 1,300 persons on our coordinated entry waiting list looking for housing opportunities. And you can wait for up to 2 years. And that's the stark reality. So what's happening in the meantime, though, is that the shelter providers have unified persons, all of those services that are offering assistance to persons experiencing homelessness have unified. And we have a 5-year plan, which is designed to create a conduit for persons who are living outside, starting off with safe living spaces, increasing shelter capacity, and then creating 200 low-cost tiny homes that will then create this conduit that allow persons to move from being outside to shelter or to those transformational housing tiny home units. And this plan has been promoted now vigorously by myself and other shelter providers, and we have started conversation with the county and city and with the business sector in trying to get this to be something that could offer intervention into this crisis situation and hold out hope, not only for those persons experiencing homelessness, but also for the community at large, the business sector, and for private homes, that together we could address this situation. And I have every confidence that we are going to be seeing movements in this area as we move forward in 2022.
Great. That was wonderfully optimistic. And now I'm going to throw the cold water on it because I happen to be on a board of a nonprofit that was asked to join a coalition to petition the Minnesota legislature to exempt tiny homes for the homeless from various building codes, including plumbing. And right. I said, well, wait a minute before we do that. Mm-hmm. Do you really want houses that don't have plumbing up the code? And I suggested to the advocates of this, I did vote for it, by the way. I didn't want to be the one guy, you know, standing out there saying no. But I ended up in a long conversation with the advocates. And I suggested, I don't know what became of this, but that the legislature, if they do this, they put a sunset on it. In other words, for 5 years, you could be exempt for building codes or whatever on particular houses, and it was very specific, but that it would be reexamined because things change.
Yes.
So, but seriously, do we want, tiny home sounds great. Everybody looks at the pictures. Gee, I want one of those and everything. But, is the answer, I don't want to call it substandard, but is that a concern or am I just a stick in the mud?
There are different models of tiny homes, some with plumbing, some without, and all low cost. But meeting code in terms of being able to withstand the elements that are peculiar to our northern region. And I do agree that a sunset clause is certainly something which could be considered, but it would only be considered if we have develop the capacity to be able to offer housing alternatives to folks experiencing homelessness. So we have over 1,300 now in need of housing opportunities. If the community is able to develop that, then by all means, we can actually put that clause in place to eliminate the need for tiny house elements.
Chris, your thoughts on that? Tiny houses?
Yeah, I think that, if we're thinking of tiny homes in contrast with building another shelter or these sort of other safe sleep sites with tents, that they offer a number of benefits. I think that it's just important based on the locality that they consider the costs of just providing vouchers or housing or, you know, other conversions. Every market is different. And also that, you know, we didn't consider this an end to homelessness, that these folks are counted in the count and that they provide spaces of which we can, you know, further organize to reach broader goals of creating this affordable housing that people need to be linked to.
All right. We've been speaking with Chris Herring, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University, and John Cole, Executive Director of CHUM, operators of the Twin Ports' largest food shelf, emergency shelter, and warming shelters. And before you go, I want to repeat the contact information for the resources we mentioned. The Northwest Wisconsin Community Service Agency may be reached at 715-392-5127. Once again, 715-392-5127. And CHUM's community outreach number is 218-461-8505. Once again, 218-461-8505. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank
you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
This is Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Our musical selection is a bit abbreviated this week, but we did want to point out something that's emerged as a deep winter tradition from one of our biggest local stars. Country blues artist and Duluth resident Charlie Parr is well known for his trademark resonator guitar that he's played around the world. But this month, he's keeping it to Superior, with weekly Wednesday performances at the Earthrider Brewery. Tim Nelson of Earthrider tells us about it.
Yeah, Charlie will be there every Wednesday through January. It's a bit of a tradition for us now. We've done it every year, probably starting in 2016. January is kind of a cold month, and Charlie has traditionally not traveled a bunch during the month of January. So we've been lucky enough to have him on our stage. We still are welcoming guests, and the Charlie shows, we will be checking vaccinations, making sure that either you had a test or you have your complete vaccination dosages. And just with the virus in its current state and being a smallish place, we felt for the safety of staff and customers would be the best route to go.
And from Charlie himself. Here's his performance of Love is an Unraveling Bird's Nest, which he shared with us on the show in July 2020. We'll be back after it with the weekly roundup of the regional news.
Let it rain, my house won't collapse. Let the wind blow just as hard as it likes. But hunker down and watch between the boughs. Bend and sway with the storm. In the morning we'll see the sun. In the winter we'll all be gone. I'll fix the broken door when we come home. Gather up all the unraveled parts. Put them right again and sweep away the leaves. All of the dying snow, all of the dying snow. Scattered all around. Now you might never notice it, but when it's forever gone, love's an unraveling bird nest falling to straw upon the ground. The fires come, we'll surrender and move on. Gather our branches in another town. Find our place in the highest part. To our new neighbors we'll nod and shake. Borrow and share and give away. It'll all come back to us one day. It'll all come back to us one day. Seasons come to an end. Can you even imagine that? When the wheel won't turn again, that's when we'll be still. That's when we'll be still. So we can look through the boughs for all our days. Watch the wheel turn. Watch the wheel turn.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Hello, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, it's freezing cold out there, but also burning up. We had a major fire in the area yesterday.
Yeah, just before 6 o'clock yesterday morning, the Superior Fire Department responded to a very large fire at a warehouse on the city's north end that actually resulted in the closure of the Blotnick Bridge connecting Duluth and Superior for about an hour. The Superior firefighters were fighting the fire from the outside. They decided not to go into the building because of safety reasons, and unfortunately, that building at 1507 North 1st Street was lost and actually spread to another building nearby. And both of these were very large warehouses that were built in the late 1800s. But luckily, nobody was injured or killed during the fires. And again, the Blotnick Bridge was closed from about 6:30 to 7:30 yesterday morning because the smoke was affecting visibility at times for drivers and kind of creating a little bit of a scare for people who were on the roads at that time. But again, luckily, no one was hurt or injured due to the fire.
All right. Well, on the political front, there's a pretty significant story going on. Not quite a fire, but igniting some passions, perhaps.
Yeah, Representative Beth Myers, who represents the 74th Assembly District, announced this week that she's not running for re-election this fall. She released a statement on Wednesday saying it's been an honor to serve for the last 7 years. You know, she was first elected to the Assembly in 2014. And since then, she's been advocating for issues, including the expansion of broadband internet for rural areas. And she's been active on workforce and aging issues because her district, which includes Bayfield County, has seen some pretty significant issues with those. Like around 40% of residents there in Bayfield County are projected to be over the age of 65 by 2025. And those of working age are expected to drop 35% over the next three decades. So she's been working on some of those challenges. And Representative Myers' district is among those in northern Wisconsin that have kind of long been viewed as a Democratic stronghold, but after winning by wide margins in 2014 and 2018 and running unopposed in 2016, Voters narrowly reelected her in the 2020 race when she ran against Republican James Bullen of Cable. She beat him by roughly around 1,000 votes, and former President Donald Trump won the district with just over 50% of the vote. And so that district is expected to become more competitive as part of redrawn legislative maps right now in Wisconsin after the 2020 census. And under the map that's been presented to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Republicans would see a slight advantage in the district, and it's now considered more of a purple seat than a safe bet for Democrats.
And that would have ramifications statewide, and as the state goes, in some ways, perhaps the country. So we will be watching that. All right, Rick, on the Minnesota side, or really both, if you're looking at the port, we lost a major figure this week.
Yes, we did. The Twin Ports lost a longtime captain of industry with the death of Adolph Ojar Jr. at the age of 72 in a hospital in Georgia. He had settled near Atlanta following retirement in 2013. Ojar died on December 30 from complications with autoimmune and neurological conditions. The Knife River, Minnesota native was the son of a fisherman and tugboat operator, and he went on to lead a robust life on the Great Lakes. He started on the docks before later becoming in charge of the Great Lakes fleet of ships, the Duluth, Mesabi, and Iron Range Railway, and the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Executive Director of the Port Authority, Deb DeLuca, recalled Ojard as a vibrant personality and strong advocate for the port and Great Lakes shipping. She said that maritime and railroad business threaded through his entire life, beginning with his boyhood days aboard the Edna G. tugboat. He became a true giant of the port world and an absolute original. We're grateful for his thoughtful leadership of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority and his contributions to our region. We'll miss him greatly, DeLuca said.
And he's also one of the forebearers of Eddie Ojard, our composing prodigy from Two Harbors, who's written songs about the Edna G. and has been on his show and will be back with us. And so we will catch up with him and send condolences to his family. On the shore, there's an auction going on that might have some curious items, or maybe some items that aren't for the whole family.
Definitely. From nostalgic to naughty, merchandise from a former Duluth head shop will be auctioned on Saturday. Signs, bongs, music, adult toys, and other items from Last Place on Earth shop will be placed on the auction block. Duluth's Last Place on Earth was shut down in July 2013, and its owner, Jim Carlson, is still serving time for the mind-altering products he was convicted of selling out of that shop, including bath salts and synthetic marijuana. And while federal agents seized all those drugs, as well as many of Carlson's other assets, some less illicit merchandise, as well as signs, remained. When the dust settled and agents had finished their work, Carlson's son, Joseph Gellerman, gathered that stuff and placed it in a storage unit. But after a while, he stopped paying the storage facility, and it gave Gellerman formal notice that he had to settle up or forfeit the contents of his storage unit. So the memorabilia merchandise will now be going up for auction at Seller's Auction on Belknap Street in Superior. Christina Green, who manages the auction house, said the sale, slated to take place at 5 p.m. January 8th, will be an adults-only event due to the nature of some of the items to be put up for bid. She said it just wouldn't be appropriate to have children in the mix when bongs, other smoking paraphernalia, and sex toys are being offered for sale. We're calling it date night. We'll be selling all the PG items first, then we'll take a little 15-minute intermission, so if anybody doesn't feel comfortable, they can go, Green said.
All right. You know, you have me there with a pretty good news item, and then I think it wandered into TMI with the party stuff. So on the subject of substance abuse, and not joking about it, there was allegedly a little problem with the Denfeld school bus driver.
Yes, there was. A commercial bus driver was arrested for drunken driving while transporting the Denfeld boys basketball team home last week. He had a very strong odor of alcohol on him and registered a blood alcohol level more than twice the legal limit, according to a criminal complaint filed Monday in Duluth. Sean Edward Zalesny of Sturgeon Lake, Minnesota, appeared in district court in Duluth 4 days after the Denfeld coaching staff asked him to pull over in Cotton following a day of erratic driving and behavior. Zalesny allegedly struck a stop sign on the way to a holiday tournament game in Hibbing. The criminal complaint outlined three gross misdemeanor charges of driving while impaired. Zalesny faces 1 year in jail and a $3,000 fine for each of the three counts. Zalesny is no longer employed with LCS Coaches, the company said.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Danielle Cading, the Superior Base reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news, and boy, did we have a lot here, anytime at DuluthNewsTribune.com and WPR.org. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Charlie Parr. Stay safe and warm, everyone.
Now take a look at their big house, bigger than they really need it. Got the dualies on his pickup when the dealer gave him a choice. Then he lost the job on the build site. Now he's struggling to feed his boys. And the red cedar grows and the red cedar flows, and long after you're gone, it's outlasting you. They can't better go. Now they couldn't go if they wanted.